This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Matt and Patrick here today. We've got coming up here a little bit later on, Peter Callahan from MinPost is going to join us as some things to talk about with him. Let me find it here. I'm scrolling through my briefs. I had it here just moments ago. There it is. Mary Clardy is going to join us as Democrat of the day, running down, I believe it's the Eagan Invergrove Heights area. And we will chat with her about her campaign. How are you today, Patrick?
Doing good. How are you doing?
All right. I will bring this up in the COVID update. But you were right. You'd mentioned we'll find out which players for the Twins have not been vaccinated. Now we know. Kepler and who's Pagan is our big reliever?
Yep. Pagan, Caleb Thielbar, Trevor McGill, all not allowed to make the trip to Toronto.
Okay. You know, it's pretty remarkable that we have the evidence that it's 2-1 people. There was a 2-1 death rate in Republican counties where they did not encourage vaccines versus the places where they did encourage them. And we have this, the reality of long COVID. It really remarkable that there are still people out there that yet just, yeah, I'm not going to get it. Even though I'm getting paid millions of dollars a year to play a kid's game, I'm not going to get vaccinated. I'll talk about that. Like I said, I'll talk about that more coming up here in just a little bit. But I want to actually start off with something that, it's Andy Mannix is an exceptional writer for the Star Tribune. He really is. And he has a tendency. I think there are times where it's really unfortunate. He is not given what I guess would be the 1980s type of investigative journalism support that we used to have, because Mannix has put out some stories which would have been the catalyst for a 3-week long investigative series into whatever. And he gets one story, and the Star Tribune cannot brush that story off the front page fast enough. It just can't. And it's infuriating because he has uncovered some really amazing things. And Mannix is very good. He has I'm going to bring this story in. I'm going to bring it back with a different thing, but I'm going to read a good chunk of this story here. A Minneapolis man who is the subject of a botched drug raid has filed a federal lawsuit against several police officers alleging they needlessly beat him during a traffic stop, and one of them later fabricated and or misrepresented evidence to a Hennepin County judge to obtain a warrant for his home. The lawsuit alleges Minneapolis officers Tony Partika, Neil Walsh, and other identified officers violated Moore's civil rights by unnecessarily and recklessly using excessive force to pull Moore from his vehicle, throw him to the ground, and beat him on the side of the road during a routine traffic stop, leaving Moore with a broken nose and other injuries. A few months later, Partika violated Moore's civil rights again as retribution for Moore's complaints to the Minneapolis Police Department about the use of force when he led a SWAT raid into Moore's North Minneapolis home with a no-knock warrant, according to the suit. Hennepin County Judge Paul Scoggin ultimately threw out the drugs and other evidence recovered in the search after Moore's public defenders exposed what Scoggin called a reckless disregard for the truth on part of Partika. Now, I want to make sure there's going to be some people that are going to hear that line. They're going to say, well, they threw out the drugs. And they say, well, see, they did search, but they found drugs. I got to think that at this point, once you get done with this story, you're going to ask the question of whose drugs exactly were they? Because I have some real questions about what the heck happened there. Unfortunately for Moore, the warrant was only quashed after he unjustly been forced to spend 7 months in jail when he was arrested for the illegal search of his residence, the lawsuit states. The Minneapolis City Attorney is reviewing the lawsuit. Hey, Minneapolis residents, guess what? You're going to have to pull out your checkbooks again to pay for more bad cops doing bad things. Because that's what, there's no way in the world this isn't going to be a big paycheck. Yee. He's reviewing the lawsuit, but declined to comment on the allegations, citing city spokesman Casper Hill. The Star Tribune first reported Moore's saga in May of 2021 after the charges against him were dropped. Chief among the questions that unraveled the case, did Partika embellish or fabricate key information from a trusted informant? We think that the confidential informant in this case may not have ever existed, said Tanya Bishop, one of Moore's public defenders in an interview at the time. What happened in December of 2019? Police dashboard and body-worn camera footage shows Partika and his partner pull Moore over after Partika said he failed to signal 100 feet prior to turning. Wow, that sure doesn't sound like racial profiling to me. Oh, wait, no, excuse me. That sounds exactly like racial profiling to me. I'm so close. It sounds like they how many white guys have ever been pulled over for the violation of failing to signal 100 feet prior to turning? Sweet Lord, I was just over here on the road. There were like five cars that never even turned on the damn turn signal to take a left or a right. Okay, sure thing there, Kojak. Doing the police work there. Wow, that's just textbook definition of racial profiling, if you ask me. Quickly after approaching the vehicle, Partika suddenly panicked. Put your hands up, he shouted, and the officers ripped Moore from his car. Immediately after Moore was thrown to the ground, Partika delivered three or four elbow strikes to Moore's left shoulder area and then kneeled on Moore's torso. Ah, nothing says Minneapolis cops than a knee to the back, does it? Officer Walsh's knee strikes to Moore's head rendered Moore temporarily unconscious, the civil complaint continues. While Moore was unconscious and thus completely immobilized, an unidentified officer pulled Moore by the hair and dragged him around on the ground. As he's unconscious. In his report, Partika said he thought Moore was reaching for a weapon. The officer searched Moore's car and found a glass pipe on the passenger, but no weapon. So Partika is a crap cop. I saw phantom guns. It sounds just like they wanted to beat a black guy. That's what it sounds like. I'm dead serious. This whole thing just sounds like he just wanted to beat a black guy. That's what it sounds like. Partika, by the way, P-A-R-T-Y-K-A. Just want to make sure everyone has got the spelling out there. Partika. Moore was booked in jail and charged with obstruction of justice. When he got on a bail and visited the hospital, he sustained a... So he clearly was injured. They chuck him in jail, offer him no medical treatment. He gets taken out on bail, goes to the hospital, has a broken nose, facial abrasions, a head injury, and a black eye, medical records show. So they broke his nose and at no point offered any basic medical treatment. God, Minneapolis cops, you suck. You're horrible. You are horrible. Oh, but I guarantee you, don't worry. I guarantee you the chief and the crew over there, they're looking into this because in 17 or 18 years, they might actually hold someone accountable here. Oh, fat wagging finger, waggy, 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 wagging finger. Moore filed two complaints against Partika afterward, but no officer ever followed up on the allegations, according to the civil complaint, because that's Minneapolis cops. On information and belief, both complaints forms were intentionally destroyed by the police before they were submitted for investigation, the suit says. Okay, the charges were dropped. A week later, Partika led the drug raid on Moore's home. So once again, Partika and his thug cops make up a crap excuse to pull him over, make up a lie that he was armed, beat him profusely in the street, throw him into jail even though he's seriously injured, make him go to the hospital where he was seriously injured, and then basically he files complaints. They threw the complaints out when they got them. Nice, Minneapolis cops. Wow. And then in turn, they dropped the charges. But a week later, Partyka, P-A-R-T-Y-K-A. If you see him on the street, say hi. He led the drug raid into Morris' home. Now, here is the thing which is interesting. Okay, I'm going to read this next part because you're going to say to yourself, oh, that sounds like a good bust. Is it? That's a big is it. The raid netted 2 pounds of meth, leading to a felony drug charge that carried up to 13 years in prison, according to charging documents. In the police report, Partyka replaced the default header with the nickname More Money, More Problems, a reference to a notorious B.I.G. song about drug dealing. Instead of the fresh mugshot, Partyka attached the photo from his previous arrest, which showed Moore's face mangled after the beating Partyka is accused of helping deliver. Over the next 7 months, public defenders Bishop and Alicia Grants began to unravel inconsistencies in the case, including raising questions about whether the confidential informant even existed. In a July 2020 hearing, Partyka couldn't explain why a bag in evidence he told the judge contained a powdery substance was now empty. Is this a material misrepresentation and, at a minimum, reckless disregard for the truth? Wrote Scoggin in his order dismissing evidence collected in the drug raid. So basically, they said they got drugs, but apparently the drugs didn't even exist anymore. In the lawsuit, Moore's attorney questioned why Partyka, a patrol cop, was leading the investigation into Moore in the first place. He was not and never had been an investigator or a detective. He was not assigned to any unit specifically tasked with investigating drug crimes, the complaint says. The lawsuit alleges Partyka obtained a warrant. God, is this just as you listen to this. A patrol cop, they put him in, it sounds like he made up a freaking drug charge with mysteriously disappearing drugs and a mysteriously informing defendant just so he could go after the guy that filed a complaint because he was upset that the cop beat him in the streets, allegedly. Wow. The lawsuit alleges Partyka obtained the warrant by falsely telling the judge that he had found baggies containing drugs in a trash bin outside of Moore's residence and that a so-called confidential and reliable source had observed Moore selling drugs at the property. So once again, this is a patrol cop who is now saying he's doing a drug investigation, and apparently he thinks that drug dealers store their drugs in trash cans outside their residence. Probably not coincidentally, the height and weight description allegedly provided by the informant exactly matched the information on Moore's driver's license, which Partyka had access to as a result of his arrest of Moore 3 months before, according to the lawsuit. The lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court in Minneapolis this week seeks damages, though no dollar amount was specified for multiple civil rights violations. Partyka is the subject of one pending internal affairs investigation and 3 open complaints through the city's Office of Police Conduct Review. If I may, how many complaints against him went into the garbage can and were completely and totally ignored? Because it sounds like there's probably a lot more complaints against this jackass cop. It sounds like there are. I'm just asking the question there, Minneapolis police, protect and serve. Wow. 6 complaints against him filed with the Office of Police Conduct Review have been closed with no discipline since 2018. In all complaints, the allegations are deemed private under state law at this time, meaning it's unclear if any relate to the Moore case. So, now, so you have drugs that are apparently were confiscated at this house. But when they go to the drug evidence locker, the drugs aren't there. There's an empty bag that's there. And you have a patrol officer who all of a sudden became drug enforcement cop saying, you don't know where the drugs went. This is Patrick. Get the tape. Make sure you're like, this is just speculation. Possible theories. That's all this is. Could it be that the cops brought the drugs in themselves from a different case, planted the drugs on the search. Then when confiscated, well, they had to get those drugs back to the original case those drugs were found, henceforth the empty bag. Or is it possibly, hypothetically, a theory? Is it slightly possible that maybe there just weren't any drugs and he lied about what was confiscated? Because once again, you have a so-called informant who doesn't even exist, apparently. I mean, this whole thing reeks. And yep, Minneapolis citizens, guess what? Thanks to Partica, you guys are going to have to write out, it sounds like, probably some very big checks for cops out of control. And let's just make sure we understand this. Clearly, something really wrong was going on here with the police. Clearly, there was. Nothing will happen to them. Oh, we'll get righteous indignation. Oh, boy. We're going to look into this. They're not going to do a damn thing. Outside of laugh and laugh and laugh at the taxpayers having to pay for their constant and unending crap behavior. Laugh and laugh and laugh. Which, if I can, let me take a break. Come on back and tie this to a different story that Andy Mannix uncovered a year ago or so. And the question is, do you really think this was the only time this happened? 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. So let's follow the bouncing ball here, okay? In what appears to be clearly a racially profiling traffic stop, Partica and other officers pull over Moore. They see a phantom gun, which he did not have, or weapon, I should say gun. They say they saw a phantom weapon, which led them to beat him profusely in the side of the road, breaking his nose, hurting him, bruising his eye, giving facial abrasions, stuff like that. They do not find anything, but still put him into the jail. They offer him no medical treatment after the beating they gave him. He gets out on bail, goes, gets treatment, realizes they broke his nose and all this stuff, files two ethics complaints, which look like they went into the circular file, to which a week later, the patrol cop, not a drug, a police officer who deals with drug investigations, apparently has information because he found drugs in, there was a report, I want to make sure I say this correctly here. Partica obtained a warrant by falsely telling the judge he had found baggies containing drugs in a trash bin outside Moore's residence. Let's just say that actually did happen, which I have some serious doubts if that did happen. How did you peg the drugs to the house? You found some drugs in a garbage can. You can't determine where they came from there, Matlock. I'm not even a cop, and I could blast away your argument, moron. I mean, excuse me, Partica. No, moron. I'm going moron. So he basically, the lawsuit alleges he falsely telling the judge that he found baggies in the trash bin, and then he has a so-called informant, which no one can seem to find, that seems to be fabricated, who apparently read off Moore's details per se. They allegedly found a whole bunch of drugs in the 2 pounds of meth that they allegedly found don't even exist. There's an empty bag where the evidence was supposed to be. So once again, hypothetical theory,
is that the drugs were drugs from, possibly, theory, hypothetical. Could it be that the drugs were from a previous drug bust? They planted them in Moore's house, and then when they needed them back for the other case, they had to take them. That's why the bag was empty. Or were there no drugs at all? Did they just completely fabricate all the evidence? We don't know. But there was a patrol cop leading a SWAT team on a no-knock warrant, December 2019. I want to bring up a different story that Andy Mannix covered. Now, this is actually the Daily Beast version of it because it's an abbreviated one, but I just want to remind people of this. Last year, and this was published in 2021, so this is from last year. So when they say last year, they're talking about 2020. As crowds attacked a Minneapolis police precinct in response to George Floyd's death, officers in another precinct 5 miles away decided the best response would be to destroy case files. A public defender now says it has jeopardized her client's case. Elizabeth Karp filed a motion against officers in the second precinct, destroying critical evidence in the case against Walter Power, 36, who was charged with felony for selling drugs. The evidence against him that was obtained through a search warrant and cell phone data, all of which have now been destroyed or lost. Karp asked for the case to be dismissed along with any order prohibiting officers from discarding any more evidence. The precinct's officers say they destroyed files after seeing the third precinct being set afire, worrying the files could be put in confidential information informants at risk if they fell into the wrong hands. Now, once again, confidential informants, which in this one case don't even seem to exist. They're said. By the way, guys, just I got good news. The Minneapolis police say they're investigating that incident. That was a year ago. They're not there. So let me just, since I'm on my hypothetical, theory train here, what if this isn't the first time this happened? What if in the second precinct, there were a bunch of cases like this? Where there was no there. Whether or not it started with a traffic incident where someone got upset and they filed a complaint and the police were going to go tell him who's the boss. Or if it was just trying to keep numbers up and it's easier to, I don't know. This is, like I said, hypothetical theory. I'm not saying this did happen. I'm just kind of just guessing at this point. I'm just thinking this through and just a possible scenario. Could it be that they basically was just easier to set people up on drug charges versus actually get the drug dealers? That Moore case happened in December of 2019. The second precinct destroyed all their evidence right after the George Floyd upset. I'm actually starting to wonder if that might be the case. How often has the police, we'll have to see in the trial of Partika, P-A-R-T-Y-K-A, Partika. We'll have to see how Partika is dealt with on the federal, thank God it's a federal charge, because I can tell you right now, if it even slightly smells rotten, it's going to go badly for him. If the federal charge, we'll have to see what happens there. But if this is found to be, he's found to be guilty, the question really isn't, well, did we catch the only one? Is how many of these cases happen? Because I want to put one last thing in your mind. So do you think a patrol officer in a well-run police department, a patrol officer could walk into a SWAT team and say, hey, can I run this raid on this house upon the guy that I arrested last week? And they would say, no, you're not SWAT team. And no, you would have a massive conflict of interest by running the raid after you arrested the guy a week earlier. That's not what apparently happened. Apparently, the SWAT team was like, yeah, come on in. We'll let you run this one. Little Billy wants to pilot the plane. Well, there you go, little fellow. We'll give you a captain's hat and a little plane to take back home with you. God, they are God. Every single time you think it can't get worse. Yee. just how many crap cops are in that department. I mean, the entire system. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. The implications of this. And if this is in any way tied to the destruction of evidence at the second precinct. Oh, God. Oh, my. Andy Mannix. You're my hero, man. That's some good work. And if you worked for a newspaper that really cared about you, that would be the beginning of a long investigation. Unfortunately, it'll be shoveled to the back page before probably the end of the day. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. Our Democrat of the day, when we do return, it is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Our Democrat of the day is running down in 53A. Mary Frances Clardy is kind enough to join us. She is looking to become the new House rep on a district after redistricting. This is a little bit of a strange-looking district, but it's got Invergrove Heights, Sunfish Lakes, parts of West St. Paul, Lilydale is all in there. Let's talk to Mary Frances, find out more about it. Hello, Mary Frances. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I was looking at this is the new redistricted 53A. It is. It's not many of them are kind of a odd shape, but this one's got it to get Lilydale on in there, and with Invergrove Heights, it is. It's a nice chunk of land down there. There's a lot of people down there right now.
Right, we have part of West St. Paul, Invergrove, Lilydale, Sunfish Lake.
Yeah, it's a
Mendota Heights. Part of Mendota Heights, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there you go, a little bit. Well, it is. It is tucked in there. A nice district. It's been growing, obviously. I was just down there 2 weeks ago. I was down in your district. It's growing like crazy over there. And it's just a lot of people are moving in that area for sure. But first of all, we'll find out more about the district, what you want to do. But let's find out more about exactly who is Mary Frances Clardy.
Oh, sure. Thank you, first of all, for having me on here. First of all, I'm an African-American female. I'm a mother, and I'm a teacher. I'm a union member and a disability advocate. I grew up in Burnsville, and we were the first Black family out there. My parents moved out there.
Wow.
In 1950. So, in fact, when my mom passed away, like 10 years ago, there's this big article in our local Star Tribune, and it said, you know, breaking the color barrier. And with that being said, they had to put like 45% down on their house, and there are a lot of efforts to kind of discourage us from living there. But my dad said, you know what? I fought for this country, and I'm going to fight for my family. So, yeah. So based on that, I ended up going to the University of Minnesota at Mankato. And after graduating, I started working in housing and knew kind of what was important was just basically to, you know, make sure that affordable housing was kind of a key factor and that, you know, people had access to it. So, after that, I ended up also, after having a daughter, kind of just looking at the school system and, you know, just focusing on that and knowing that equity was a huge thing there. So I went to college to become a teacher.
An incredibly amicable position, if you ask me, especially after what we've seen in the last, it's been a rough few years here. And obviously, I think there's so much, okay, you just unpacked a lot. And I'm trying to figure out where we can start with, because your experience that you would bring into St. Paul is a must. I mean, you have to have people with this kind of life experience. I want to kind of go back a little bit to your perspective on equity in housing is probably rarely surpassed in this day and age. Your parents were the ones that broke a color barrier in the suburbs. And that was 1950s, folks. We that wasn't that long ago. It wasn't that long ago. And the reality is as we are looking around now, and I don't think we nearly, you know, there are some, you know, people who are individually
you know, against, you know, certain mm-hmm. people moving into certain areas. But the reality is it's changed a lot, but we still have a lot of places we need to work to make sure equity is truly being achieved when it comes to housing.
You know, we really, really do. You know, like I said, my parents had to put that portion down. But I also think about, like, the whole school system. So I went to school in Lakeville, but, you know, like I said, I was born and raised in Burnsville. And the importance of that is when my daughter went to school, like 20 years after I graduated, she faced some other institutional type racism or questions like her teachers would say, please keep the beads quiet in your hair.
Wow.
So that was their focus at that time. And that's how I got into teaching. And being a teacher, we see everything. We see the health of the community, you know, access to health care. We see access to housing, but, you know, what that looks like when it's unstable, like when families have to all of a sudden get up and move away because they are in a place where, you know, they either can't afford it or it's just not safe to be there. So there's a lot of issues that keep us centered. I love my job as a teacher. When I was maybe like 10 years ago, no, not 10 years ago, 6 years ago, I got hit over the head by a chair from a student.
Oh, no.
And got a traumatic, I got a traumatic brain injury. Oh. And the reason I'm mentioning that today, because I basically had to relearn everything, how to walk, how to talk, how to read, count back from 100 and everything. But the reason I'm mentioning that is I also got a peek into, you know, what it's like living with a disability and how important it is for us to get services to people and not have barriers, you know, in their way to go through systems.
Now, once again, I got a lot more. You bring up with the disability and whether that's a temporary disability, and not knowing what your circumstances are, and please forgive me on that, but I mean, whether it's an individual with a temporary disability or a long-term disability, you're right. I don't think we've talked at all with any of the politicians that we've had come on in here more about the need for more, you know, disability spending, medical spending, you know, community services for disabled people, because you're right. It's one of those things where it takes you having to go through the system to see where the gaps in the system are.
Right. And, you know, I have a lot of, you know, coworkers or friends or family members actually that may be considered with a disability. And for people that aren't dealing with those types of situations, they think, well, they have all the money, they have all the services, and it's like the connective services, helping people go through that, you know, helping them navigate it. And these are some of the issues that are really concerning to me, especially like with the area of mental health or just access to health, because we see it with our children. And it's just access. It's not that people choose not to get a service. It we need to make it a system where everyone can thrive.
There is so many different angles we could go and talk about education. The Republicans, just the Senate Republicans this last session, put forward a nonsense bill that wasn't going to help any of the school districts outside of one specific program, which was championed by the chair of the Senate Republican chair of that committee. You have unfunded mandates still being pushed on these school districts. You have, a need for funding, a need for mental health funding, a need for more accessibility, for more equity. I mean, there's from your perspective, mm-hmm. I mean, all these things, if you're there on the ground in the school doing the teaching, you see once again where the gaps are, and that actually gives you a very, very big advantage when it comes to representing the people of 53A.
You know, I feel like that's really true. I mean, we don't necessarily always purposely choose their background, but part of it is I've also been on the other side in the sense that governors, like two different governors, have appointed me to some boards that oversee policies for schools or for like superintendents and principals and, you know, teacher licensure, which is a whole different area because, as we know, there is a lack of teachers of color in the school district.
Yes.
And therefore, there's a lack of administrators. So it's kind of this vicious circle. But teaching is one of those professions where we need to have basically an apprenticeship. You know, if this is a shortage, what are we doing to make a difference? What, you know, how are we holding the parties accountable for, you know, getting people into the profession? And what we also know by research is that just having a teacher of color doesn't only benefit students of color, but it benefits all the students.
Mm-hmm. No, my son went to, he's at the U. His freshman year there, when the classes he had an African-American teacher. And the first thing the teacher says is, how many of you in this class am I the first non-white teacher you've ever had? And they almost all of them raised their hand. And he said, and it pointed out to him, yeah, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense that I would. And it's because he didn't necessarily go out to some tertiary or quadriary suburban school. He was in a first ring, second ring suburb school district, and with a strong minority population, but yet there still wasn't a lot of minority teachers and representation. I will say, in my kid's school district, the administrators, there's a people of color in the administrative ranks, as well as also there's many minority groups represented now within the teachers. But it's something. It's a slow crawl to get that to get that rectified and get that fixed.
Right, but there, you know. It's a complicated situation, but I also know that I went on an alternative licensure program, and I know there's been a lot of legislation or a lot of conversations around that. And the point being is that I was very successful in my life prior to being a teacher, and that was one of the components. But there is ways to make, if the focus is increasing that population to reflect our students, There are ways to do it. There's ways to have people get compensated for going to school, or just there are ways to do it. There are ways that the schools and school districts can do it. It all costs money, but there's creative thoughts, and there's ways that people can put back into the society.
You know, I also want to take a few minutes here to mention, by the way, you and I mean, my gosh, your story is amazing. And I could talk, just on your life experience alone, you would be a gem in St. Paul, because your point of reference. How many committees could we put you on out there to where your direct life, housing, health and human services, education, my God, you would be a treasure trove of knowledge. I, by all means, we have to get you there. But let's focus on the district for one quick second. As we talked about the district, it is a growing district. The Vikings put their place out by you guys. You got all that development. Robert Street, coming out of West St. Paul, that is just becoming a lot of business, a lot of growth, apartment complexes. That's one of the things I like to talk about with the suburban candidates, is that, talk about growth and how you feel it is the right way to make sure growth is achieved in a district.
So one thing that's a very good question, first of all, but one thing that's very important, and it addresses some of the environmental concerns as well, is that the planning needs to be very thoughtful. When I say that it addresses the environmental concerns, oftentimes there is some urban sprawl, and part of that is not only because the not my backyard type of thing, but also it's people that have a better choice, which is like affordable housing, because everyone deserves that, moving out a little further, but then it causes a huge carbon print, right? So the planning needs to be very thoughtful. What are the environmental effects? How will the people that are living adjacent to the changes will happen? What does affordable housing look like? And that type of thing. And basically, who has access to that? Mm-hmm. Because we have a lot of youth that are from the LGBTQ community that are homeless because they can't access housing to different reasons. We have a lot of people that are young, a lot of people older, a lot of people with disabilities. So what does that look like? it's not something that we can just say we should build 100 houses or that everyone wants to be a homeowner. It should be something where everyone has access to, you know, having stable, affordable, you know, great housing.
Yeah.
And have long-term solutions around the unhoused. Because Minnesota, there hasn't been huge dialogues around the unhoused, but it's something we definitely need to make a plan for.
And you say it correctly, and what I mean by that is that there's this tendency, I think, to believe that when you look at growth, you look at just build a bunch of houses. We'll build some subdivisions. It'll look real pretty. There's homelessness in every single town in the state. It is right there right now. And you brought up the LGBTQ plus community. The reality is in every community, there are young people who are homeless because they've been thrown out of their house or they can't find housing. You have to make sure that you're addressing their needs as you do it. Because if you do it, as you say, from the beginning, you generally don't have the problems that other communities have when they just build subdivisions and then wonder why they have problems.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Don't want to just throw a bunch of things out, but there's one other thing that's really near and dear to my heart. I was in a fortunate situation where my parents were able to pay for all of our college degrees, right? I ended up getting divorced when my daughter was, like, younger. So when she went through college and she chose to go that path, she ended up with huge educational debt. And that's definitely another issue that we need to, need to work with when we're looking at all the other, you know, areas like housing and stuff. How do you buy or rent something when your educational debt is, you know, more than your housing?
No, exactly. No, it's why are we taking, when we're talking about college graduates, the people that are doing, you know, starting off making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, why are you saddling them with so much debt that it basically makes them a far less better consumer within the system on the front end when they need to buy all the stuff as opposed to later? So no, there is an absolutely, as a capitalist, there is a really good, you know, logic to basically making sure people come out of college with as little debt as possible, because then it helps spur the capitalist system and the free market system. You get that. All we're doing right now is starting people off with, you know, a leg and a hand tied behind their back.
And then if you don't mind, there's just one more thing I wanted
sure.
to throw in.
Please.
It's kind of connected to, like, I'm, you know, like I said, I'm a teacher and I see everything. At least they try to. But the whole issue of, like, gun safety, for me as an elementary school teacher, the day after the big recent mass execution at the elementary school, it was really difficult to go to school and have conversations with children. It was also, like, maybe 3 days later, we had a fire alarm drill, right? Mm-hmm. And when that alarm went off, the children jumped. And so it's the trauma of the children. It's the trauma of the community. It's the trauma of the teachers. It's that whole piece that we need to take some time in and collectively figure out what's going to make great common gun sense.
You and I could talk for another hour. Easy. Today, unfortunately, I'm running out of time. Mary Frances Clardy is once again the candidate, 53A. Mary Frances, if people want to find out more about your campaign to get into St. Paul, where should they go?
Well, it's clardyforhouse.com. That's CLARDYFORHOUSE.com.
I will link to that. I'll cross all the social media platforms a little bit later on. So go to my social media. You'll find the links for her website. If you're in a safe DFLC, great. If you're not, help out your local DFLer. But if you're in a safe district, get down to 53A and let's help Mary Frances get to St. Paul, because obviously she is clearly someone we need at the Capitol right now. We absolutely need to have her there. Mary Frances Clardy, 53A, Democrat of the day. Mary Frances, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much. I look forward to working hard for everyone.
I look forward to having you back on the air. I look forward when you're a representative because we have to have you in St. Paul. Let's take a break. Come on back. We'll wrap up hour one when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Wow. Mary Frances Clardy. Wow. That is a candidate for the DFL. It's interesting. Yesterday, we had a Democrat on the day on there. We were talking about how there are some of the districts where they're not even running candidates. Ann Rest was here. She was talking. Senator Ann Rest was here. She doesn't have a challenger. I went and looked yesterday, and by far there are far more. There are some seats the DFL is not running candidates in. Not many. I think it was 5 House seats and 3 Senate seats. There is 12 House seats that the Republicans are not running anyone in, and I thought it was 5 or 6 Senate seats. And I don't think it does us any good not to have a good debate, because the reality is that we want to have the best candidate. This is a great example. This District 53A, there's going to be a challenger down there, and that race is going to be close. But listen how good Mary Frances Clardy is. She deserves to be in St. Paul. They need her, and that district needs someone with that kind of experience in St. Paul. That's a candidate that makes not only her district better, the state better. You have to have these debates. You find out about these great candidates, and you get them on in there. So I look forward to 53A. We'll put that interview up a little bit later on. Hour 2 is up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Friday. Matt and Patrick here. Short week is nice. It's nice, and it's also nice to be in the June with the June swoon. Oh, I think the plants got screwed up by the spring. I think the plants got screwed up. So I got silver maples in my yard. They got all the helicopters. Hardly any helicopters this year.
I noticed there weren't really a lot of helicopters either.
The other thing I noticed is lilacs generally, I've got plants that are blossoming, like delphinium and stuff. And I got columbine coming in and some other ones. Usually the lilacs are done first. I see a lot of lilac bushes where they're not yet out. And I'm like, okay, that's a little weird. That's a little odd. But I hope you have a wonderful, it's supposed to be a gorgeous weekend, a little chance of some showers tomorrow night, but overall it looks like a nice weekend here. Do you remember how many years ago did you graduate high school, man?
It'll be 13 years.
Oh, gosh. I don't even want to say. What 86. What was 86? How many years ago was that? 20,
36.
That's why watching Stranger Things is so much fun, man, is I'm reminded of, oh, my God, they actually, the people that do the sets and the clothing and the hair in that show, holy cow, that is as spot on as it gets. Did you ever pull a prank on the old school on the last day of school?
I don't believe our class did a senior prank. I can go into detail if you want why we didn't do a senior prank, but other ones before us did.
Did the authoritarian administrator have a paddle or something like that back then?
No. For the most part, the reason that we didn't do a senior prank was because our class did not like each other and did not want to spend any more time together than we had to. I think another thing was...
Which kind of school? Squid Game High?
it was kind of like Squid Game High.
Make sure you're standing still. I got to give this one breaking news out of Prior Lake. Prior Lake's high school lunch period erupted into chaos on Thursday when a group of conspiring seniors released pigeons dropped flour and water balloons from an overhead railing. Speaking of Squid Game, Savage Police Department Detective Mike Schlitz. Schiltz. Got to be careful with that one. Schiltz said 2 18-year-old male students were issued trespass warning for school property cited for disorderly conduct. Others involved in being disciplined in the district with occurring during our busiest lunch period with over 1,000 students. Maybe you should build a second school. I'm just saying. It doesn't take too much to cause a commotion, said Principal John Bezek in an email to families, adding enhanced security and patrols will be around the school campus in the evening. Bezek said most of the students involved have been identified, will be suspended or removed from graduation. Interesting. Please talk to your students about your expectations and possible consequences for their actions. I inform students that this behavior is unacceptable and it will go down on their permanent record. Oh, no, actually, no. It's they will be suspended from both school and activities they're involved if they decide to make poor choices. Late Friday afternoon, they learned about the fate of the two pigeons, who were reportedly stowed in backpacks before being released. One pigeon was been safely captured and released. Okay, you're in a lunchroom. How did you get the pigeon out of there? I mean, I was like, oh, I'm good. No, I'll stay here. It's a lunchroom. They're still working on catching the second one. There you go. He's decided, I'm not leaving. I like the cut of this place's jib. That's up there. That goes beyond painting the other school's rock or trying to steal the school's mascot or anything like that. Yeah, you don't see them TP the school that often anymore, do you?
No, you definitely don't. I don't know if that's a school's kind of got a little, we're not going to hesitate to file vandalism charges if you do something like that, or I shouldn't say file. I mean, pursue them to have someone else file them. But I don't know if that's kind of a thought process with those kind of pranks.
Completely unrelated story. I got to share this before we get into the interview here with Brett. So Biden makes his speech last night about, you know, we need more gun safety regulations. Immediately after that, not all Republicans, but a lot of Republicans started screaming about gas prices are out of control. And that was my, and I post about this morning. I said, there's my sign. They know they can't win on gun safety issues. They're frantically trying to get this back to gas prices. That's all they're talking about. And I actually posted that this morning. So then I ran at the Y. Get out of the Y. Going down, got to get gas. I'm over on, Hopkins Crossroads and Cedar Lake Road. There's a gas station over there. A Holiday, I think it is. I pull up. I get out of the car. And there's a guy on the other side. I go and put the gas pump in. And behind me is this guy just raging, talking, just going, kind of going loco a little bit about the gas prices, screaming, doing the old screaming about Joe Biden. Thanks, Joe Biden. $5 a gallon gas. Oh, Biden's the worst. I mean, really loud. Really loud, really obnoxious. Now, reminder that this is, there were a lot of people that immediately came on out after Biden got elected and vandalized gas pumps across the country by putting their stickers out there that cost like $25 as they're complaining about, 40 cents more per gallon of gas. But still, Republicans, what are you going to do with them? But it was just this, he was kind of, he had a buzz cut and he had a goatee and he's can't believe Joe Biden. And he's really loud and blah, 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 blah. And I didn't really think anything of it. So I go over and because my girls finished up the school year, I went and got some flowers for them, really pretty flowers. And I'm in the parking lot of the florist. There's a gas station right next door. And I swear to God, there's a guy there. This guy was older, thinner guy, had a full head of hair, no goatee. But he was saying basically the same thing. Joe Biden has made gas $5 a gallon. Joe Biden this, Joe Biden that. Just really loud at the gas station. And I really just stopped. And I said, This can't just be coincidental. You can't have two raging rightos showing up at two completely different gas stations, way apart from each other, and screaming basically the same script at the top of their lungs. Now, mind you, my gas was at my pump was $4.45 a gallon, but then I used a discount card and I got it down to $3.80 a gallon. So it sucks to be you. You got to be a smart shopper there, goatee boy. But that's irrelevant. I actually think that was some sort of coordinated kind of, we've got to get the public thinking about gas prices and not about gun safety. How do we do this? Let's send rageaholics to gas stations to obnoxiously scream about how it's Joe Biden's fault my gas is expensive. I swear to God, I think that happened. If you saw anything like that today, you're more than willing to either comment on the live stream, or you can call Patrick. If you saw anything like that, where there was a group, there is a guy at a gas pump just screaming about Joe Biden's fault, especially one that looked like a real righto, let me know, because that just was weird. That all of a sudden the Republicans did it, and I mean, even the Star Tribune came out with a story with it. I don't know. It seemed a little bit too contrived. That it was just individual of each other. Just wait a minute here. You got two guys saying basically the same damn script, 10 miles away from each other, doing the same exact thing. So, did you see any? Did you have to get gas this morning or anything like that?
I did not, so I haven't seen anything about this.
If you see something like this, let me know. All right, if you do, because I'm wondering if this is they got into big trouble. Actually, there was apparently someone was threatening a class action lawsuit for gas stations to get all those damn stickers off the pumps that they put on there. So they basically we're sorry. So now that are they to basically just having people just go to gas stations start screaming while they fill up gas? I don't know. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Our friend Peter Callan, who will not return my messages. I do not know why. Come on, Peter. I like you. You're a good writer over at MinPost. He is talking to Brett today about primaries versus the party endorsements, as well as also education funding and special education funding. And apparently the taxpayer is paying the lawyers for the redistricting. Apparently that's going to be an issue too. He sits down with Brett Johnson right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Friday afternoon. Well, today we're joined by Peter Callahan, who covers state government for MinPost. You can find all of his writings over at minpost.com, as we're going to be talking about why Minnesota lacks competitive primaries this August, special education funding, and a possible special session that could be in the works in the coming days and weeks. Peter, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Appreciate it.
Okay, good to be here.
Absolutely. So Minnesota is not likely to see many hotly contested primaries for statewide offices when, of course, we do hold our statewide primary in August. And as you write, that's pretty much exactly the way both parties want it, and is probably one of the few areas where the Republican chair David Hahn and the DFL chair Ken Martin might agree. In fact, Ken Martin was quoted in your piece as saying, "Endorsements are the earliest opportunity for the party to unify. You don't have to engage in a costly primary that essentially drags out into the summer and early fall, distracting you from efforts to take on Republican candidates directly." So talk about why both parties really like this endorsement process more than going straight to the primaries. Is it just simply the idea that they love the idea that they can coalesce around one candidate rather than trying to have a hotly contested primary all summer that could distract from the general election? Talk about what both sides were kind of saying when it comes to preferring generally having these endorsement conventions have precedent over a primary.
Well, it's interesting that a state chair can refer to elections as a distraction and nobody seems to bat an eye. And it really says a lot about politics in Minnesota that aren't really the same in other states where primaries are much more where the action is. If I'm a party chair and if I'm a party activist, I prefer the format that gives me the most power and authority. And if I'm one of, 1,600 people or 1,200 people in the Republican case who voted for Scott Jensen, I'm that much more powerful than I would be if I was one of 250,000 people voting at an August primary. So those folks who enjoy that power want to keep it that way. And so it's in their interest and in the party's interest to make the candidates pledge to not run if someone else gets endorsed. And most candidates do that, because if you don't, that doesn't guarantee, but it certainly makes it harder to get the endorsement from those same people who don't like candidates who don't pledge to honor the endorsement process. But there is a difference between the two parties. It's 30 years since rank-and-file Republican voters at the primary have rewarded a candidate who didn't get the endorsement at the convention. The Democrats have done it quite frequently. Mark Dayton was not endorsed when he won his first term, and Tim Walz was not endorsed when he won his first term. Neither, however, had pledged to honor the endorsement. Neither did Tim Pawlenty 4 years ago with the Republicans, but he got what every non-endorsed primary candidate on the Republican side gets. You know, his hat handed to him, and he was defeated pretty handily by Jeff Johnson.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about this. I know you hinted at that the electorate is very different from the primary versus what you would have at a political convention, simply because, well, at a political convention, you're only talking about a few hundred, maybe a couple thousand people versus a primary where pretty much anyone in the state is allowed to vote. So I think it's important to point out that these are very different electorates when you often hear the parties making big deals about how their candidates need to abide by the endorsement, when really, when you look at it, the electorate for who is making those endorsements is very, very small compared to who votes in a primary.
Yeah, I mean, someone could make the case that the 1,344 delegates who gave Scott Jensen the endorsement in Rochester last month are representative of, say, the 320,000 who took part in the Tim Pawlenty-Jeff Johnson primary. You might argue that they're a representative sample. I'm not sure they are necessarily. I mean, there's certainly going to be conservative Republican people who are voting in both of those two both of those two election processes, but I think the intensity of interest for both parties, you're going to get real strong advocates for either candidates or causes who go through the process to get to a convention, and the folks who show up at a primary, their adherence to those issues and their affiliation with the party is going to be much more tenuous.
So how do political parties go about trying to pressure candidates to abide by the endorsements? For instance, I'm looking at what's happening in the AG race now for the Republican nomination, where Doug Wardlow kind of went back on what he was saying earlier, saying he was going to abide by the endorsement. Now he announced he is going to run for the primary. So talk about some of the ways that parties do try to pressure candidates, because obviously the Republicans, at least within the party right now, are not happy that Wardlow is seeking the nomination. So what do they do to try to avoid these types of contests?
Well, again, they pressure them to make a public pledge beforehand. Sometimes at the convention proper, they will make them stand up and say whether or not they are going to abide by the endorsement process. And, you know, you have an out if no one gets 60%, which is the threshold that both parties have for endorsement. So you can kind of hope, if you're not getting the endorsement, that the convention ends with no endorsement. Then everyone is free. They are not held to any sort of pledge because there's not an endorsement. And, you know, in 2018, when Aaron Murphy was leading, Tim Walz and Rebecca Otto sort of got together and said, hey, let's get together and vote no endorsement instead to try to stop Murphy from getting the endorsement. I mean, that's all fair game. But once you pledge, you're kind of expected to abide by the pledge. You know, unless you can come up with some rationale that the process was flawed or you were somehow mistreated, and you can question the legitimacy of the endorsement process, you're kind of expected not to run. And I think party folks, even if they were intended to like you as a candidate, they don't look well at people who do not abide by their pledge. And that's what Doug Wardlow is going to face in the Republican Party. And the party, before he filed, and he waited till the very last day to file, they were trying to pressure him both sort of publicly, internally, not to run and to abide by their endorsement. And he ended up not listening to that pressure. But I think it's very difficult in a partisan primary, especially one with Republican voters who tend to, and I say tend to, only because 30 years ago, Arne Carlson was not the endorsed candidate. He was, however, the incumbent Republican governor. He beat the endorsed Republican that year. So almost every time in 3 years, if you're not endorsed, you don't win the primary. And so that's what Doug Wardlow is up against. And then, you know, he probably wants to be around in politics. He's a pretty young guy, and he's made a lot of enemies among rank and file and leaders in the Republican Party.
And final point on this, and this is something you brought up earlier, how generally the Republicans have more success trying to abide by endorsements than the DFL, since, well, obviously, as you brought up, Tim Walz and Mark Dayton were both elected governor despite not getting the endorsement. Do we have any reasons why Republicans have generally had more success in terms of trying to avoid these types of primaries, at least from looking at history and even talking to some DFLers or Republicans? I know it's kind of a speculative question, but it is interesting that both parties do have kind of different approaches or at least results when it comes to abiding by endorsements rather than going to a primary.
Yeah, those were maybe exceptions that prove the rule. Because if you get down to local elections in the state of Minnesota, if you're not the endorsed school board candidate in Minneapolis, you're not going to win a primary or a elimination type election. Same thing for oftentimes for city council, for park board. Voters, at closer levels definitely abide or follow the endorsement process, and it's hard to get by without it. You get into something like the governor's race, where a lot more money is being spent, or a lot bigger campaign, it might be easier to overcome the sentiments of the type of voter who looks closely at the endorsement. But you're right, it's speculative.
We're joined by Peter Callahan, who covers state government for MinnPost. Make sure you go to MinnPost.com for the latest in Minnesota politics. I want to move on now to talking about what's happening at the state legislature. In a recent article you wrote titled, "How Providing More Money for Special Education Would Actually Mean More Money for All Minnesota Public Students." And as you write, if the Minnesota legislature ever convenes in a special session, and if the Fighting Education Committee chair ever decides to agree on spending $1 billion for the surplus for schools, and if the other committee chairs reach an agreement on their budget bills, it is likely that school districts across the state will get more money for special education. But if the legislature agrees to help resolve what is known as the special education cross-subsidy, it won't increase funding for special education at all. If you had trouble following that, you're not alone. It is a very confusing formula to try to figure out how special education gets funded. So let's talk about this as you write and back up, because special education is a mandated service by the federal government for all American public schools and even private schools as well. And like I said, it's not just for public schools. So talk about how special education typically is paid for, because as I understand it, the federal government should be providing a lot more money than what actually comes in, and that largely leaves it up to the state and local districts to figure out how to fill that shortfall, and that's kind of how we get to cross subsidies, correct?
Yeah, correct. It's, this is one of those legendary unfunded mandates that comes down. The federal government 30 or more years ago mandated that school districts provide the services to students, and again, not just their own students, meaning if you're a private school student or a homeschool student in the jurisdiction of a public school district, you are able to make yourself available for those services. And it's paid for, and it's the first dollar that has to be paid by school districts. The feds had pledged when that happened to cover about 40% of the cost. It really only covered 10-15% of the cost. And so the state and local funding sources are the dollars that you use for education, and the first dollars go over to special education. So if the state was to increase the amount of money it sent for that particular bucket, it would allow districts to essentially pull out money from general education that they had been using to pay for those services. So it's right now a couple hundred, $200 to $300 million extra that could be flowing out to the districts in a school year. And that's real money that would then, in fact, not enhance special education services, but could be used for other things, class size, other programmatic things that a district might want to do instead.
So now talking about how to increase funding and try to help schools out in this area, what are some of the ideas we've seen at the legislature to try to reduce district cross subsidies? Because as I imagine, the DFLers and the Republicans probably have different ideas on how to try to deal with this issue.
Well, to some degree. I mean, at that level, once you know that the funding, additional funding for anything is not going to go into special education, all dollars are green at that point. So you can either increase the formula, which is sort of a student-based, need-based formula that districts get money from the state based on a formula. You could increase the formula, the amount per student that the legislature agreed to do last year in the budget that we're still living under. They got a fairly significant increase in the formula funding. You could, as the DFL tends to prefer to do, is to send money specifically for other programs, say mental health counselors, or the R's want to boost literacy and reading programs. You could send the dollars specifically that way and tell districts, okay, you need to spend this money for that. And in this case, what they're doing is would be doing if they agreed on this cross subsidy dollars is sending that money to districts. Again, in reality, they can use it for however they wish to use it, but it doesn't go into the formula. So it's not your paycheck. It's not your salary that you would get year after year after year. It's sort of one-time money that would disappear unless it was reappropriated next budget year. So those are the three ways. You know, districts, I think, prefer to have dollars driven out in the formula because it's steady. It's very difficult to then take it away. It doesn't really even need additional appropriation by the next legislature because it's already been formulated and promised to districts. That's how they would prefer it.
Gotcha. Well, for a lot of this to happen, we, of course, would need, at least this year, a special session for some of this to occur. And I want to get your take on what the prospects are for a possible special session, since we still could technically have one. What are you hearing right now in terms of the governor possibly calling a special session and how receptive members of the legislature have been? What's the latest you're hearing right now?
Well, the governor and the House Speaker, Melissa Hortman, and Senate Majority Leader Jeremy Miller had a virtual meeting just this afternoon and agreed to virtually nothing. So what they came out of it was saying, we're going to try to encourage the committee chairs to kind of have some chats in the next week and see if they can move things along. And then we're going to get together in a week and see how things went. The odds of a special session are falling because there are Republicans just don't seem to think that there's any interest or need to do that. They felt like they made a deal 3 weeks ago. They blame the DFL chairs for not reaching agreements. They don't appear to be getting a whole lot of pressure from their voters and their constituents. I'm sure they're hearing from their school districts and things like that, but really, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of pressure, and that the Republicans particularly have decided to take this to the election. Walz and the DFL would really like to get some of those spending bills passed, but it's right now, there's a saying that the best way to win in negotiations is to not want anything. And the Republicans right now are at least making a good appearance that they don't want anything. We'll know more in a week, but there did not seem to be a whole lot of momentum for a special session.
Well, and one of the reasons why some members of the legislature do want that special session is that at least when it comes to the budget right now, we do have, well, it was a $9.25 billion budget surplus, but as I know you write about, well, that number has been revised now closer to $7 billion. And if we end up not having a special session, then that surplus could grow to $12.1 billion next year, which is down from the $16 billion that was projected earlier this year. So talk about why these numbers are changing so much, because at least that is significant right now, where we at least thought the state had upwards of possibly a $10 billion surplus. Well, now it actually is closer to $7 billion. So I'm just curious as to why that number got reduced, and even looking at next year's budget, how that number also got reduced as well, the projected surplus.
Because they spent it.
Yeah, they spent it. Well, there you go. Easy enough, yeah.
It's not because the economy has changed or the revenue projections have changed. They did pass bills this mm-hmm. session that spent that money. That was the unemployment insurance fix, the mm-hmm. Health insurance premium reinsurance program. That was the hero checks for pandemic frontline workers. That was $500 million. And they put another $190 million into the governor's kitty for emergency COVID response. So the reason that number dropped is simply because they spent a bunch of that for those other things that have already passed earlier in the session.
Well, that would make sense. Yeah, they would include that spending in the projected, well, the numbers that they have in the future. So if you're curious as to why no one's saying we have a $9 or $10 billion surplus anymore, well, we've already spent about $2 or $3 billion. Well, we are just about out of time. We have been speaking with Peter Callahan, who again covers government for MinPost. You can follow his work over at MinPost.com. Again, that is MinPost.com. Peter, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Appreciate it.
Always enjoyable, Brett. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. Thank you to Peter Callahan for joining us from MinPost. If you're not subscribed to MinPost, by the way, that's a very good news outlet. I would highly recommend getting a subscription there. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. So, two things that we usually cover here. First of all, we've been covering the gun violence issue. Can I give credit to The Daily Show for putting out videos? They put out an incredible video where it basically just has all these people over all these, you know, gun massacres, these slaughters that are happening in our schools, and thoughts and prayers, and that's it. And, you know, the point making is they're not doing anything else. The other one that they did, which I thought was great, was the insanely confusing statement that you'll hear guys like Jim Jordan and stuff say. It's like, no one wants a slaughter in the school, but... I think you mistake but for period. That's it, period. Nobody wants a slaughter in the school, period. End of discussion. There are two states which have put forward putting forward laws that basically mandatorily arm teachers. And I've already gone over this multiple times. I'm going to do it really quick and again, and just because I want to make sure you understand how this is just a red herring. They are asking teachers to do something, first of all, that they should never have had to do. I mean, we can stop this gun slaughters. We'll put a big dent in it by bringing the Brady Bill back and banning the AR-15s. We'll do a lot with that. As a matter of fact, I was reading the Washington Post that's saying that how many of these shootings are happening, people are buying these guns with the intent of going out and killing and committing a massacre. So if all of a sudden those guns aren't available, well, maybe you can do a lot there. Doesn't infringe on your rights. You still get firearms. You can still have a defensive pistol. You can still get a rifle. But you just can't get the weapons that are designed to kill as many human beings as quickly as possible. Because sane societies would realize, hey, that doesn't seem like something anyone would really need. The argument that they're trying to make now is that it's the teacher's job is to, while they're, you know, teaching geometry, to all of a sudden be able to take out a terrorist. And I've said this before. I was in the U.S. Army. I can just tell you this is such a garbage argument. And what they do is notice they don't bring the teachers in to make the argument. What they do is they come out here and say, we're going to arm these teachers. And the entire point of this is to blame the teachers for the slaughter that's about to happen. But as I'm going to explain here just now, it's a false argument. So you're teaching a class. A psychopath wearing full body armor kicks open your door and start spraying the room with an AR-15. Now, clearly the teacher can't be, you know, hopefully the teacher's not the first one killed. But, I mean, I still, Republicans would still blame the teacher. How could they die so quickly? I mean, they will. But just for hypothetical sake, let's just say the teacher is sitting there and is the horrific witness to the children in their classrooms being ripped to shreds by bullets from an AR-15 fired by a clearly mentally compromised individual wearing full body armor. That teacher is somehow going to pull their weapon. Now, that weapon will have to be A, right on their hip, with not even a latch in place. So they're just going to have to, they're going to have to pull that weapon, okay? The weapon has to be loaded. Has to be loaded. It has to be. There's no other way around it. It has to be loaded. There has to be a round in the chamber ready to fire. The safety has to get off. And that teacher is somehow going to get into an advanced firing position where you can get the most stability because you're going to have to aim. You can't just flail and hope a magic bullet hits a man wearing full body armor. That you're going to have to train them how to, you're going to have to hope they're expert marksmen, because even when I was in the military, there weren't guys that could do this. But you're expecting a teacher to do this that might not even want to have the gun. But a reminder, you're expecting people to do this. They're going to have to get into a firing position, aim for a very specific part of the body armor, and pull a bullet in there and hope it's enough to drop the shooter. While being sprayed with AR-15 bullets while all the kids around you are getting gunned down. That's your best case scenario with the weapon on the hip. There's no way in the freaking world they will be able to do that. There is no way in the world they'll be able to do that. And like I said, when I was in the military, there were multiple times where guys had, you know, tried to pull that stuff off on the firing range, and they couldn't hit the target. But you're expecting a teacher who 1 second is now, here is the radius of the curve. If you get pi out here, it will tell you what the area of the circle. You're expecting that person to all of a sudden drop everything. Grab that weapon. Once again, unabated, safety off, round in the chamber, pull it up, get the army, and then be able to pick out a inch by inch square of body armored shooter who's moving, by the way, themselves. And be able to put that round in that spot and hope that it drops them. The entire argument of arming teachers is just so that Republicans and pro-gun kooks can blame teachers when the next slaughter happens. End of story, end of discussion. It's not about stopping it, because there's no way on the planet a sane person would think that this was going to work. There's no way on the planet a sane person thinks that's going to work. But it's not about stopping the shooter. It's about, because they don't want to, frankly, the gun industry doesn't want to stop the shooter. On one side, you have people who are terrified who will go buy guns. On the other side, you have sickos who want to find out the exact make and model of the gun that they used to slaughter all those kids so they can get one. And they can say, hey, I got one of those guns that the guy used to kill all the kids. They're sickos. So they don't want to stop the slaughters. They just want to be able to blame the teachers. That slaughter wouldn't happen if that teacher was somehow the greatest marksman the military had ever seen. But unfortunately, Marge, who's in her 60s, is just an English teacher. We know who's really at fault here. It's Marge. God, it's just... And we just had a shooting in Ames, Iowa. You had a shooting at a funeral in Milwaukee. There's a reason why the Republicans are frantically screaming about Joe Biden at gas stations right now, because they can't. There's nothing they can say anymore that can appease the people. The people, 90% of the population wants common sense gun safety regulations, and the Republicans, because they are being pulled by that NRA chain / Russia, they basically. We're going to put John Cornyn. John Cornyn is their point person in the Republicans in the Senate. Cornyn has already said there's no way over his dead body that he's going to pass any new regulations. Nope, not at all. But that's their moderate moderator that's going to bring forward some ideas. Please. They're only looking as a, who can we get teachers to be blamed? The teachers? Can we get other union people involved somehow and get them blamed? I don't know. I mean, it's disappointing. It's disappointing. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. The other thing that we do every day is the coronavirus update, and let's get that going here because things are starting to change a little bit. It's definitely getting better. This wave, the BA2 and all of its children, I guess you could say, that wave is starting to curtail. The Omicron lineage of COVID-19 has been dominant in Minnesota since before Christmas, but another group of subvariants is soon expected to replace the current dominant strain. According to the latest wastewater data from the Metropolitan Council, the most prevalent strain in the coronavirus from samples tested May 24th to 30th was Omicron subvariant BA2121 at 64%, which is up from the 57% previous week. Meanwhile, Omicron subvariants BA4 and BA5 more than doubled from 11% of samples taken on May 17th, 23rd to 23% of the latest reporting period, and that's expected to continue to climb in the weeks ahead. BA4 and BA5 are expected to replace BA2121 as the dominant strains at the Metro plant wastewater in the coming weeks. The CDC has not expressed concern that BA4 and 5 cause more serious illness than previous Omicron types, though they are extremely transmissible. And that's the Omicron thing, is they're wildly transmissible, but they don't seem to be overall as sickening as the other strains have been or as deadly as the other strains. Doesn't mean people aren't dying. People are still dying. It's just not at the obscene rates we were having under Delta and the original Omicron strain. Those are hyper-contagious, said Gregory Poland, head of Mayo Clinic's vaccine research group, in a podcast recorded May 13th. Both Omicron family members, BA4 and 5, are known, just like other Omicron subvariants, to escape vaccine and natural immunity. BA4 and 5 escape not entirely, but very efficiently, that immunity. But once again, we are seeing the numbers kind of going down. So let's take a look at the numbers. Friday's COVID-19 update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 1,968 newly reported cases, 15 reported deaths. You guys want to have the audacity to tell me the pandemic's over? We had 15 people die. 15. Wow. In Minnesota alone. That's in Minnesota alone. State's COVID-19 death toll now is 12,664. According to the latest, we just went through that, the variants in the wastewater, which ones are the most prevalent. Through June 2nd, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota was 446, down from 475 on June 1st. Of those hospitalized, 42 people in intensive care, that's up from 39, 404 in non-ICU care, down from 436. As of May 31st, the state reported that 3,917,330 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 3,712,874 people have completed the vaccine series. There are 2,442,560 Minnesotans up to date with their vaccine shots, including boosters, and the total number of people. And once again, this is a gross undercount of the total number. 1,515,742. And as we mentioned a little bit earlier, the Minnesota Twins are playing their series. They play at Toronto this weekend after getting drubbed. If I can take a side note to make the point, they lost 4 out of 5 to the freaking god-awful Detroit Tigers. God-awful. In the last three games, in 27 innings, they managed, that powerhouse lineup managed to only get 2 runs. In 27 innings against that pitching staff. Well, thank God Toronto's a much better team. God, this is not going to go well. Needless to say, yeah, I'm not expecting this to come home. Hopefully they can get back home and get back into winning. The Twins will play 3 games Toronto Friday through Sunday without one of their starting outfielders and 3 relief pitchers, all of whom have been placed on the restricted list because Canada does not allow you to just travel willy-nilly there if you've not been vaccinated. And so this is a way for us to find out exactly which players in Major League Baseball have not been vaccinated. Max Kepler, Emilio Pagan, Caleb Thielbar and Trevor McGill. Is it McGill? M-E-G-I-L-L?
Yep, that's Trevor McGill.
Were placed on the restricted list of heads to Friday's series opener. The Twins have not said why each player was placed on the restricted list, but Canada's federal policy mandates foreign nationals to be fully vaccinated before entering the country. Pagan confirmed to Betsy Helfand of the Pioneer Press that he's unvaccinated, saying he feels like he's letting the team down, but he made a decision he believes is the best for my health and for my family. Against every science and pretty much a legitimate scientist on the planet. But okay. It's unclear if Kepler, Thielbar, or McGill have revealed their vaccination status, but Kepler did tell Helfand that it's sad he can't join the team in Canada. Oh, he's got the boo-boo feelings.
And Kepler is the weird one to me because he makes his off-season home in Germany, and I'm kind of thinking...
How did you not have to get vaccinated in Deutschland, man? They're just in case you haven't been there, they're quite a regimented people. I mean, they like schedules. I'll say it like that. I didn't think you couldn't. I didn't think you could. I got some friends still in Germany that are there. I didn't think you could to turn down the vaccine there.
At least not get in. Like if that was my thought was, well, if he wanted to go home this past off season, could he get in? And I don't know. Maybe he just stayed in the United States all winter. I don't know, but that was my thought when I was surprised he ended up on the list.
Maybe because Germany does not have a deep roster of baseball players because he's one of the better baseball players Germany ever gave us. Maybe they made some exceptions. I don't know. But, yeah, we'll have to see. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. I'm going to take a flashback to my youth. Speaking of the 1980s. I'll give a flashback to that here for you when we do come back with the dance out music for a Friday. It's the Matt McNeil Show on an AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. By the way, one thing I didn't get with Mary Frances Clardy, who is running for 53A, the Democrat of the day from last hour. There's a legalized marijuana candidate in there. Now, I'm not saying it's not a legitimate legalized marijuana candidate, but let's remind ourselves we've actually had clearly there were some legalized marijuana candidates that were run as basically people out there to try to tear away votes from the DFL. I don't know if that's the case in 53A, but reminder, the DFL is the party who wants to legalize marijuana. And as opposed to one of these fringe groups, they're not going to get it done. I did want to make sure I mentioned that, but that's just, I saw that. And I'm like, okay, is that, and I'm going to ask this for every legalized dope candidate out there. Are you legitimate or are you a Republican plant to try to basically pull away some votes? And before you get mad at me, you're the party. Your political party should have had some bellwethers and gates to prevent stuff like that from happening. I'm just, that's on you guys, not me. 952-946-6205. Back in 1985, the Edina High School Pops concert, I sang this song. Frankie Valli, Grease. It's going to take us out this week. You have a wonderful weekend. We're back on a Monday. Till then, see ya.